You're listening to Inside the Village, where all news is local and no topic is off limits.
So help me, Bob, it's Bully in the Alley.
Across the Village Media Network and wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and we certainly hope that ours is one of them, this is Inside the Village for the week of April the 18th, 2024, with Michael Friscalanti, editor-in-chief here at Village Media. Derek Turner, executive producer, is in the room. I'm Scott Sexsmith. We should tell you, as we sit here and tape this, we're following the Tigers game because somebody's a fan. You're all excited. They've come back to tie it up.
Our regular listeners would know that, right?
Of course.
We didn't have Matt Betts on this year, right?
The
Blue Jays season.
We did not have Matt.
Maybe the Jays will do better.
Maybe. Tough game last night, losing it in the ninth.
Did you guys lose in the ninth?
Yeah. Love the story you were just telling us about Al Leiter, a former Blue Jay pitcher.
Yeah, isn't that great? Well, he's making his debut today against the Tigers.
His son.
Remember Al Leiter and his brother Mark Leiter, I think? They're both pitchers. Both their sons are in the major leagues. It's the first time ever.
That's crazy.
First time ever. That's the best thing about baseball. The stats are endless.
Yes.
This is the first time ever that two brothers both had their sons play in the major. And they're all pitchers. It's like they're just
good genes.
Bred to be pitchers. Yeah, for sure. Good arms.
Good. Yeah, absolutely good arms. But he's getting rocked.
He's getting rocked 7-7. Yeah, we're not cheering for Al Leiter's son, whatever his name is.
Leiter's getting lit up.
Lit up.
Okay, it's a great time of year, really. Baseball. Hockey playoffs, the Masters it's fantastic if you're a sports fan.
It's a great time. The Masters is also always reminds you that spring is around the corner. The hockey playoffs, I'm a casual hockey fan. I was just asking Derek, like, when do they actually start? I feel like they should have started by now. Like it's
this weekend.
This weekend. Yeah. Right? And who are the Leafs playing? Boston.
Boston. Do they start in Boston or Toronto?
Boston.
In Boston.
So Boston's the higher seed?
Yeah.
Oh. And from your Trillium Talk episode, Aiden Shamandy was way off on how many goals he thought.
He was so off. It's a good thing he's a good political reporter because he cannot call anything when it comes to hockey. Shamandy did not get that right whatsoever.
That's crazy. Who's your hockey team? The Leafs?
You know what? This is going to sound like I'm sitting on the fence. Thank you. I don't really have a team, but I'm a Patriot.
Oh.
And I have always believed that the Stanley Cup belongs in Canada. Is that corny?
No, it's been like 30 years.
I know. 1993, right? Montreal.
31 years, yeah.
Montreal, yeah.
So who are the Canadian teams in the playoffs this year? Winnipeg?
Winnipeg, Vancouver.
Edmonton
and Toronto.
So there's four.
Yeah.
That's not out of 16. That's not bad.
Sportsnet will love that.
See what happens, yeah.
All right, let's move ahead here. The first word to Frisco, some great stuff we're going to talk about today. Let's start in Sault Ste. Marie, and it was a shocking week. After 125 years in operation, the local YMCA all of a sudden closing and selling its building.
Yeah, speaking of athletics, this is a super sad story. We've seen it unfold in other communities recently. The Aurelia lost their Y, I believe, a few years ago. But the YMCA is suddenly shutting its doors. They're closing down all the programs. Hundreds of daycare spots are in jeopardy now. People who've been members there for decades are out. And there was a pretty angry meeting yesterday with the CEO and then and a board member. And people wondering, and I wonder this too, why just shut it down? Why didn't they tell us a year ago or 6 months ago there were some financial issues and maybe people could have rallied around the facility? It just seems like a huge loss that maybe didn't have to happen the way it happened.
And if you knew that, and again, I mean, easy for us to, you know, armchair quarterback this or backseat drive this, but if you knew that you were in that much financial trouble that long ago, to your point, would you not have tried to initiate some kind of a fundraising campaign and be completely transparent with the community and say, you know, here's the nuts and bolts. We need some money. We need your help.
Well, that's where the anger is coming from. And I think it's also the frustration over the unanswered question of why. There was kind of this vague discussion at the meeting yesterday about, well, for legal reasons, we can't talk about these things, but there was something big that happened about 5 months ago. And it's like, well, you know that story is going to come out.
Of course. Where,
you know, our reporters are digging hard and people are talking around town. And it's eventually going to come out. And as someone pointed out at the meeting, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? The place is going to close? It's already closing. Like, you should be honest with us and tell us what's happening. I think that frustrates people the most. They're going to lose this place they love, and they want to know why.
Yeah.
It's a fair question.
It is a very fair question. Okay, we talked off the top about the NHL playoffs, which start this Saturday. The OHL playoffs have been underway for a couple of weeks now. We're into round two. And an interesting story coming out of the North Bay Sudbury series, where people who lived in North Bay were blocked from buying tickets for game 3 and 4 in Sudbury.
Yeah, these stories always make me laugh because I'm new to the OHL. I live in the Sioux and I do like the Hounds. I'm a casual fan, but playoff time, I become a big fan. And we have communities that we serve where they're big into their OHL teams. We have Guelph, for example, Sudbury, North Bay, Barrie. And North Bay especially, they have some pretty intense fans that love to travel around and see their team, the Battalion. And I guess they were playing Sudbury and Chris had this scoop out there about how if you tried to order tickets in Sudbury from North Bay for games 1 and 2 and you put in your address as North Bay, you were blocked. They weren't going to let you buy tickets, right?
Yeah.
So they were trying to basically hold the tickets for all the Sudbury fans. So the people that were going to head down there on a bus were pretty upset. Just made for a great Northern Ontario rival story. And I think it was settled in the end. They eventually let these buses come.
I think they did, but they kind of looked after their own first and then slowly opened up the opportunities to buy. We did a great behind the scenes with reporter Chris Dawson on this story. You can search that at baytoday.ca and go behind the scenes with Chris on that. Okay, finally, the first word to Frisco and our last word. Just a lovely story from reporter Richard Vivian out of Guelph. A Guelph love story, 75 years in the making.
Yeah, you've read this story and I've read it. It's one of those that's going to make you tear up. I remember him, he was telling me about it a couple days ago at an ideas meeting we have all the time about there's this couple in Guelph that they just celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary, which boggles your mind, let alone celebrate your 75th birthday, let alone your 75th wedding anniversary.
Crazy.
And it's just a beautiful piece about how the lady is, Margaret Mary is at a home and Charles gets on a bus to come visit her every single day just to hold her hand and the powerful quote about how he just doesn't want her to forget about forget who he is, right? And, you know, they've raised their kids together. They traveled together. They lived their life together. It sounds like a beautiful life together. And, you know, it just makes you shake your head, because it shows you how quickly life can go by. But it's also amazing that people can have a love story like that that's not in the movies.
All right. Check out that story at Guelph today as we wrap up the first word to Frisco. All right. On today's show, I'm excited about this. We've never had a judge on the program.
Yep.
Granted, he's retired. Retired prosecutor, respected judge, and also an Elvis impersonator. Of course, Norman Douglas. He's just written a brand new book called You Be the Judge.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book that kind of the idea was born. He used to go to high schools and talk to students about the justice system and would say, well, what would you do in this scenario? You be the judge. And it kind of gave him this idea one day to write a book. He is now retired and he put this book together and it touches on a couple dozen of cases he was involved in, both as a Crown and as a judge, lays out all the facts for people and asks them to be the judge. And it is a great, we talked before the show started, that we rarely see a window into this world, right? Mm-hmm. People have strong opinions about the justice system, but you don't really hear from people like a judge who has sat on the bench and been there and understands the nuances of everything. So it'd be a real refreshing conversation. I'm anxious to ask him about all the things that are in the headlines right now about the justice system. I'm sure Storm and Norman, as he's known, will have some strong opinions.
I'm sure he will, and we will get to those opinions and much more when Inside the Village returns right after this.
Reporters, editors, and journalists who go the extra mile to get the story and get it right. Go behind the scenes with those who cover the stories that matter most to you and your community. Look for it in the Village Features section of your favorite Village Media website across Ontario.
I was drowning in debt, feeling hopeless. Then Ontario-wide Financial turned my life around. Ontario-wide cleaned up my credit and gave me the help I needed. Now I'm starting fresh. Don't wait. Your fresh start is just a call away.
Across the Village Media Network, welcome back to Inside the Village with Michael Friscalanti, Editor-in-Chief here at Village Media. I'm Scott Sexsmith. He's a retired prosecutor, respected judge, and an Elvis impersonator. We'll get to that in a sec, but we're very pleased to have the author of the book, You Be the Judge, with us today on the show, Norm Douglas. Norm, welcome to Inside the Village. It's great to have you here today.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Mike.
Okay, first things first, got to get this out of the way. Any truth to the rumor that your nickname was Storm and Norman?
Regrettably, yes.
Really, regrettably, yeah, really.
Well, sometimes I think the people that thought it up were trying to be complimentary, but it turned out to be a kind of a nice moniker, actually.
Sure.
Wasn't that also General Norman Schwarzkopf?
That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, Storm,
sure they
yeah.
stole it from that. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Lots to cover today, Your Honor. So let's get right to it. I've always wanted to ask a judge this question. How hard is it to separate your personal feelings when you're sitting on the bench presiding over a case?
Well, everybody's human. And obviously, there are things that I have to keep under control, and there are things that I have to completely, to use a legal phrase, disabuse my mind of. We take an oath, and we take it seriously. And the oath is not to let your personal feelings, your upbringing, et cetera, override your legal duty. Now, judges aren't all supposed to fit the same mold. We're chosen on the understanding that we have, you know, live lives where things have affected us. And some of us, are different colors, different sexes, different races, you know, and that's the way it should be. You don't want, one judge fits all.
Norm, we want to talk a lot about your book, You Be the Judge. It's a fascinating idea for a book. But before we get into that, just to explain to our viewers a bit about who you are. You were a longtime prosecutor, then became a judge. Tell us about your career.
Well, I'm from the Sioux. I was born in Hawk Junction. There was no hospital in Wawa when my dad came back from World War II. And so I ended up being born in a 6-room hospital in Hawk and spent a couple of years in Wawa before we moved back to the Sioux, where my family was from. And I grew up there. I went to public school there, and I went to high school there, collegiate. And when I went away to university at Queens and got my BA degree and LLB degree, there was an opening in the Crown Attorney's office in the Sioux. Doug Gates was the Crown Attorney at the time. And I came back for an interview and was hired. And that's how it all started in 1973.
So as a prosecutor, you're just again, for people to understand, you're dealing with criminal cases. You're the crown. You're trying to get the conviction in these cases. But you're also there to decide whether you should even prosecute a case, correct? What goes into the mindset of a prosecutor as a case comes across your desk?
Well, unbeknownst to the public, we probably don't proceed with or withdraw a great many of the cases. We don't take every case to court that the police bring us. Mm-hmm. And we usually have a pretty good working relationship with the police, and we talk it over with them, and they bring the investigation, and we might, say to them, well, there's a few holes here or a few holes there or whatever it is. But so we don't proceed with everything, and our goal shouldn't be just to seek a conviction. Obviously, we believe in the case or we wouldn't be prosecuting it, but we owe a duty to the accused to be fair, and we owe a duty to the accused to stand up and halt the prosecution if we think we can't prove it. And so even before we take a case, there is an onus on us to say there's a good prospect of conviction here. We don't take cases that we know are full of holes, even if we think the accused is guilty. At least we shouldn't. And we have a duty to not proceed when we don't think that we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
You were definitely part of some very high-profile cases here in Northern Ontario. One of them that sticks out to me was a tragic case of a 14-year-old girl who was killed at high school here in Sault Ste. Marie. You were the prosecutor on that case. What kind of a toll does that take, being involved with such a horrible crime?
A big one. Mm-hmm. This case is one of those that's highlighted in my recent book. And the accused name was Caldwell, Russell Caldwell. And he murdered the young Mastriani girl, 14 years old, in the school washroom at Cora. Mm-hmm. This was in 1987 that I prosecuted the case. And the thing about that case, and it's one of a few, I couldn't help but get personally affected and involved with the family. You have to interview the family members. You have to, get to know them a little bit. And I did in that case. And I stayed friends with them even after the case was over. And I don't know if you want to get into it now, but there's a really interesting story of what happened a couple of weeks ago at my book signing up there involving mm-hmm. family.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Well, that case was so heart-wrenching. There's still fallout. There's still, people now, if they want to go to the washroom in high school, there's a buddy system. I mean, it changed everything,
Yep.
So it was tragic, and he was convicted, and he was sent to jail for life. no parole for 25 years. But after 25 years, he could apply for parole. So that was, I think, in 2007. You can do the math yourself for 25 years. But the Mastroianni sisters both went to Kingston for the parole hearings and made it a point to fight for their sister. And they did this, I think, three times, that they had to go all the way down to Kingston, appear there, relive the whole thing, and stand up and say, this man should not ever be paroled. And so the last time they did that was the Friday, a couple of Fridays ago. They just got back from Kingston, and I was having a book signing on Saturday in downtown Sault Ste. Marie at the West of Petro's Scripture of Gifton bookshop. And there was a lineup, and it was so heartwarming for me to be there, and I was really enjoying it. And all of a sudden, I did a little double take at a couple of women who were standing there waiting in line. And it didn't click at first, but when I was finished signing the book for the person in front of me, I gave them a better look, and it just hit me who they were. Mm-hmm. And they had come to the book signing, and I hadn't seen them since 1989. Mm-hmm. One of them became friends with one of my daughters, you know, and so we hugged and we cried. And it was just such a knee buckler for me. And then one thing that the oldest daughter, Carmela, said to me, she said, you know, you've been part of our family since 1987. And it just went to hit me again that when a person murders someone, they don't just kill one person, you know. They have an effect that they kill a whole lot of people in different ways. Mm-hmm. And this was just evidence of that.
And, you know, it's true. And that case in the Sioux in particular still resonates all these decades later because it was such a horrible crime, because it happened in a high school bathroom, and also because these people, the family is well-known parts of our community. People know them. They work in the community. And it's still devastating. And we continue to write about this. I wrote an article about it a few months ago about the parole hearings coming up. And a lot of people came out of the woodworks to write letters for the family. And which brings you to my question, Norm, is that you work so deeply on a case like that as a prosecutor, and then you become a judge, and you have to then kind of be the independent referee, so to speak, in a similar case. I mean, that must be – do you find yourself going back to when you were a prosecutor thinking of the cases you prosecuted, and now you're on the other side?
And changing perspective, right?
Changing perspectives.
Yeah.
Well, I did a column on Premier Ford's call for tougher judges.
Yes.
And it was called Define Tough Judge, because you can't. You can't be a tough judge. You can't be a soft judge. You've got to be tough and soft. It depends on the case in front of you. And every case is different. And every case comes with its own set of facts. And you just become a judge, it's obviously you're not a player now. You're more a referee. And you can't jump in and get involved. And you just have to abide by the oath that you've taken. And some people thought I was tougher on Crown attorneys than I was on defense counsel when I was a judge, maybe because I had a higher standard for them. I don't know. But it really doesn't matter whether you're from the defense side or from the prosecution side. If they have enough confidence in you to choose you as a judge, then you should be able to divorce. You know, you're not rooting for anybody. You're just making sure that the Crown is held to a high standard to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they don't, even if you believe the person is guilty, you find them not guilty.
Norm, I want to jump to the book in a sec. But before we do that, just you brought up Premier Ford. So I want to ask you, what did you think about his comments about like-minded judges?
Well, I wrote a column on that, and I wrote a column on more jails, and I just wrote a column on bails. And this goes to a company called LexisNexis, Peter Carter, Law 360, but goes all across Canada. I didn't slam Premier Ford, as some of the media said I did that read the article. I simply challenged his views and respectfully disagreed with him. And I don't know where he's getting his advice from. I'd like a chance to sit down with him and say, look, I understand what you're saying, but if you really want tough judges, man, you want to go to some of these countries, overseas where they've got tough judges. And you get a lot of innocent people sitting in jail, too, you know?
Yeah.
And so you want to be careful when you throw terms around like that. And we don't need tougher judges. We just, the judges that are being appointed now are excellent. The bench that I know, and they are tough when they need to be, and they're kind and compassionate most of the time when they can be.
It's a fascinating conversation, Norm, because you've worked your whole career in a courtroom. I have spent a lot of time in courtroom. I've covered a lot of high-profile cases, fortunately, as a journalist. And people ask me about the justice system and whether it's broken. And and I try to explain the same thing, that there's a huge balance that goes into the justice system. It's not so cut and dry. For example, people have said a lot lately, politicians have said a lot lately about the catch-and-release issue,
right,
that too many guys are getting arrested and let out the next day. Is it really any different, Norm, than it was when you were a judge? Are these guys being let out more often?
Mike, how many people do you know that have sat through the beginning to the end of a criminal case in a courtroom?
Yeah, very few.
Most people get their ideas about the justice system from headlines, mm-hmm, from TV. Mm-hmm. And the system isn't broken. The system needs a lot of monitoring, and we need to keep, looking at ourselves if we're doing the right job. But the catch and release, the presumption of innocence. Think about this for a minute. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's charged in Canada with a criminal offense is presumed innocent. Mm-hmm. A large percentage of people in jail today are awaiting trial. Therefore, to use the syllogism, a lot of innocent people are sitting in jail waiting for their trials, right? Mm-hmm. It's the system that we have. Now, they're presumed innocent, right?
Yes.
And that's the catch. Certainly, some people who are awaiting trial are dangerous if you let them out. It would lose confidence in the administration of justice, the public confidence in the system, if you just caught and released everybody. I just did a column today before I came on here about people who steal $22.5 million gold released, or a guy who steals a bottle of liquor at the LCBO because he's got a record, he's held in custody.
Yes.
Of course the people are saying, what?
Yeah.
But we need to draw back the curtain, which is what I tried to do in my book, by the way, so that people know that judges are human, but we care about the system. And we're trying to do our best. And if we just get a chance to explain that and show that somehow, well, then maybe people would have more confidence in the judicial system. We can't explain it. We can't go public. I can do it now because I'm a retired judge.
Yes, yes.
As a sitting judge, I couldn't.
No, exactly.
I had to keep my mouth shut. So yeah. How am I going to educate people if I can't say anything? I tried with a grade 12 high school losses, which is where the judge idea came about, by the way.
Yes, yeah, that's a great story. And you're right, and hopefully this podcast episode will help explain it a little bit. But just speaking of explanation, I think what I try to tell people is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Norm, but it's easy to say, oh, we should keep all these guys in jail. But the system wouldn't function if we did. We would have thousands and thousands of people, and where would we put them all? There has to be that balance. Is that accurate, Norm?
Well, sure it is. You've got the two extremes, like you do in every tough issue. One, well, the police had enough evidence to charge the guy, so keep everybody in jail until their trial. That's the other. And the second view is, well, release everybody because they're innocent until proven guilty, and defund the police while you're at it, So you got those two extremes. You know, my solution is very simple. If we all kept the golden rule, keep all the laws, we don't even need.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that'd be the perfect world.
All right, let's get to the book, Norm. You Be the Judge is the title of it. And if I understand correctly, you take 24 different cases and talk about the complexities of it, and they vary in significance. I want to start by asking, how did you decide which 24 cases, out of all the cases that you've been involved with over your storied career, how did you nail it down to those 24?
Well, some just jumped right out at me. There were two cases that I did where a person was convicted of murder, one was sentenced to hang, paroled, and murdered again. And so that was a no-brainer. Those two cases are extremely interesting with very important issues about the parole system, et cetera. So both of those were from Sault Ste. Marie, by the way. So there were 12 homicide cases that I chose that had interesting issues in them. And I was for 10 of those, I was a prosecutor, not the judge. And then there were 12 of the most challenging cases I had as a judge that, you know, I could have gone either way, and or I got criticized for going one way. So I chose those 12 with the view to saying, okay, here are the facts. What would you have done? When a new judge is appointed, they sit with an experienced judge for a couple of weeks and watch what happens. And then they're thrown into the deep end and they have to do their job. When I wrote this book, I had the reader, I pictured the reader sitting beside me as a new judge, let's say. And we're both sitting there and we're both seeing the cases. And I get to say to that person on recesses and on breaks, well, what do you think? What would you do? You know, that's how I viewed myself when I wrote the book. And I chose those cases that they're going to be, you know, different views. They're going to be people who read the book who say, well, why did you do that? I don't understand it. But at least they know why I did it, because I explain it. So it's set up that here's the facts. What would you do? You don't know what I did. You decide. Then you find out what I did. And then we can talk about it and exchange respectfully different views. The first case in there, I got pilloried by a number of college students at University of Guelph for what I did with a guy who was charged with sexually assaulting a co-ed. And if you just read the headline, you'd say, what's that judge on? You know, how did that guy get a break?
Damn but headlines.
Case, yeah, that's right. If you look at the case, then maybe you understand why I did what I did, instead of saying, all right, let's hang the judge.
Norm, tell us about the stolen phone booth.
I won't tell you the result because I wanted to buy the book.
That's right. We'll be sure to flash up all those details. Right. Yeah.
But it was one of those cases where I'm sitting in my robes and my tabs, and I'm looking all official with the big crest behind me, and I'm trying my darndest not to laugh. This guy was in a bar, and he and his friend walk out, and they see this phone booth, and the guy decides that would look good in his rec room. Got a truck and a chain. They rip the phone booth right off the four metal posts that it's sitting on. They're driving down the highway with sparks flying, and he's taking this thing to his house. And an OPP officer's driving down the highway, and he sees these sparks, and he thinks, what? And he pulls the guy over. Then what the guy says to him? What's the problem, officer?
That's great.
I'm going to leave the rest because I don't want to lose 35 cents out of every book I sell.
We don't want any spoilers here, and you'll have to get the book to see if you threw the phone book at him.
But Scott, most of the cases are not funny. You know,
of course.
Most of the work we do is not funny. I always say it to new judges, you know, take your job seriously. It's a serious job.
Very.
Just don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's great advice for all of us. Norm, as you wrote the book, did you find yourself ever second-guessing the decision you made, or have you ever second-guessing like I'm back and said, you know what, maybe I didn't do that case as well as I should have?
Yeah, I have second-guessed. I did a case, one, and it's in the book, where I got rapped by the Court of Appeal. And the idea was, you know, you can't do that, Judge Douglas. And I knew it at the time. But I did it anyway, and it involved a woman who was charged with impaired operation of a vehicle, which I was not an easy judge on, by the way. I don't have a lot of sympathy for drunk drivers. Mm-hmm. But I gave her a break. The reasons are outlined in the book. And I actually, struck her plea and found her not guilty, even though she pled guilty. But that's, you can read about that too. Sometimes you second guess yourself, but hopefully, that doesn't happen very often in your career.
I've often wondered what that's like, because I've covered a lot of Ontario Court of Appeal rulings as well, and their judgments that are overturned, lower court rulings. How does that impact you as a judge? Do you feel like you made a mistake when the Court of Appeal overturned something you've
done?
Or
do you feel slighted?
Yeah, do you feel slighted, or like, do you want to call these guys up and say, come on?
Well, you might, but I'm watching the Blue Jays.
Well, there's
it's a frustrating pastime, but they're instant replays and the umpires.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, so they got overturned. They go about doing their job.
Yeah. And
I respect the Court of Appeal that overturns me. That's fine. I'm not. You know, there was one case in my career where if you Googled me, you'd find out what case that was. Where it was just wrong what somebody did, I got upset about it, and I paid for it. I ended up before the Judicial Council and got my knuckles wrapped. But I've had a colorful career, and it all hasn't been perfect.
Yeah, it sounds like it. This is really inside baseball, to stick with that metaphor. Do you have a chance to ever like see the Court of Appeal judges and actually have a debate about a decision they made involving your course? Or do you have no interaction with those people?
Well, you do. You have social interaction. Some of them are friends. I mean, Robert Pachaco is from Sault Ste. Marie.
Yes.
He's on the Court of Appeal, and some of the Superior Court judges, Ian McDonnell is another Sioux boy that made it to the bench.
Yes.
And Caputo, and you can go on and on.
Yes.
But you see them and you joke a little bit, but you don't get serious about that.
Yes.
That's the job. That's not social.
Yes.
So Norm, you talk about taking the job seriously, but not yourself seriously. Is that where the whole Elvis impersonator thing comes into play? A little bit of escapism for you?
What a lead into that. Good for you.
Hunka burning love right
here.
He's
the master of that. He's the best.
Well, thank you very much for that question. You're right on the money. That's exactly why I did it. I love music. I've always loved music. You know, some judges weren't too happy about me putting on a white jumpsuit and, doing Elvis. They thought that was, unprofessional. Most judges said, good for you. It shows the human side of the judges. And but music has always been an outlet for me, still is. You want to come to another room, we can sit at my piano. But I was in a band called the Boomerangs.
Boomerangs,
Boomer's music. And we did a whole set where I was in my Elvis suit and did 12 or 13 Elvis songs. And I just found it so relaxing and so enjoyable and so much fun. Then I'd go back to the job the next day and, don a different suit, a black suit this time, and have to do a very difficult job. Those of us who have difficult jobs, all of us, we need an outlet, Scott. I mean, let's face it, we are human. And that was the main sort of reason why I wrote the book that I did. I just wanted to draw back the curtain and let people see judges for who they are.
I was going to ask you that. Was there a bit therapeutic to write a book like this? I mean, can you speak to that?
Yeah. Good question, Mike. Absolutely. And and it's not like I had as tough a job as, some of the first responders or anything. I'm not making it sound, awful. It's a great, it was a great, great ride. Mm-hmm. But there were times when I just got, down and thought everybody I looked at is a criminal,
Yes.
And they must be. I mean, look at all the evil in the world, but
yes.
You can't. Yeah, that's not true.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel that same feeling in the journalism world. We kind of think the world's falling apart everywhere we look, every headline. So it's nice to know that there's some positivity out there. Do you miss it? You miss the job?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I was still doing it. And I foolishly really didn't plan very well for retirement. And I just, I was loving my job so much and enjoying the ride. All of a sudden, bang, I'm 75. I can't sit tomorrow.
I know.
But yeah, I do. And but I'm grateful. I'm tremendously thankful and grateful for the opportunity that I had. I mean, I did well in school, but I was never any good in math or science. I couldn't hammer a nail without, breaking my thumb. There's a lot of things I can't do.
Mm.
But I love to read. I love history. And that just was something that allowed me to do some of the practice some of the limited skills that I had, and law has been a blessing to me.
Norm, I know you had a bit of a health scare back in 2016 with a cancer bout, took 5 months off, came back to the bench part-time in 2017. How are you feeling now?
Talk about being grateful and thankful. I was one of those ones who went through a stem cell transplant and 5 months of chemotherapy and radiation. I was one of the people who got through it. And so I still go monthly for blood tests to the hospital, and they still keep an eye on how I'm taking a drug every day that battles it away. I've got multiple myeloma, so it's not curable, but it's manageable. And my prognosis in 2016, when I was diagnosed, was probably not more than a couple of years. And here I am, and I can tell you something. I'm going to do this for you. I can still do the Elvis kick. we're all on radio, not TV, right?
Oh, no, it's on TV, oh, too. No. It's all on,
yeah.
TV.
On TV. Oh, yeah.
Our podcast goes all across the network. Everybody sees it on our website.
You didn't tell me everything.
Yeah, no. If I go back to the email, I'm sure it said video as well.
Well, just a minute.
That's okay. Look at Scott, Norm. We're fine. Yeah. You're fine. You look great. You look great. Let me ask you that. First of all, it's great to hear that your health is feeling good. Definitely. Now. That's fantastic news. You sound great. When you do, you obviously are still thinking about the law all the time. You're writing columns, as you said. Is there something about the justice system that should be changed, in your opinion, that would make it maybe more accessible, more understandable to the people, or just in general? Is there something, if you were in charge, if you were the Minister of Justice, for example, what would you do one thing to make the system better?
One of the endorsements of my book, one was by former Governor General David Johnson, another Sioux.
Yes,
by
another Sioux, yeah.
But there's a journalist, you may know her. Her name is Betsy Powell.
Yes.
She's been a crime reporter for the Toronto Star for years.
Yep.
Well, she got a manuscript of my book and wrote a really generous endorsement. And what she said is what I would change. And that is the secrecy of it. And I think she might have been the one who coined the phrase "draw back the curtain," taken from The Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm. that I've used ever since. And that is, we should welcome the public into the courtroom, and we should go out and talk to groups, and we should give the judges a little bit of a leash if it's educational, mm-hmm. to... But by and large, you know, when you compare our system with the system in other places in the world, I can't think of a whole lot of things that I would change. It's not perfect, but it's the best we have in the world as I see it. I think our system is better than the system in the States. I don't know of a system that's better than the Canadian system of justice, as difficult as a lot of people might find agreeing with that. But that's my feeling.
I agree with you. I think the system works extremely well 99.9% of the time. I think the challenge, again, is someone who's spent a lot of time in courts, and I understand how they work as journalists. We cover a lot of different trials. I'm not sure how you draw back the curtain. Do you do that by putting cameras in the courtroom sometimes? Do you do that? Because it is open. Anyone can walk in, but I know the vast majority of people don't ever do that. How do you actually draw back the curtain a little bit?
Well, I think, forgive me for this, but write a book called "You Be the Judge" and open the gates and let people see, and read about what's going on there, and not just, take a headline and jump to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And, that's one of the reasons why I would go to high schools when I was a judge. There were five high schools in the area where I judged for 20 years in Guelph. And every one of them, I would go and we would play this game. You'd be the judge. And I would take the opportunity, and a lot of judges do, to go out and educate people on what we really do and why we do it. And I think that helps.
All right. This has been a wonderful chat. Norman Douglas, I love the line, we're all human and we all put our white bell-bottom pants on one leg at a time. The book is called You Be the Judge. Norm Douglas, Your Honor, thank you for this today.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks, Mike. Good meeting you.
Last year, financial stress had me at my wit's end. I felt trapped and embarrassed that it had gotten so bad. I really felt I had nowhere to turn. That's when I called Ontario Wide Financial. Their home equity lending was a game changer for me. Despite my bad credit and being in a consumer proposal, they helped me get the cash I needed. Thanks to Ontario Wide Financial, I've started this year with hope, not stress. They gave me a fresh start, and they can do the same for you. Ontario Wide Financial, because everyone deserves a second chance.
Reporters, editors, and journalists who go the extra mile to get the story and get it right. Go behind the scenes with those who cover the stories that matter most to you and your community. Look for it in the Village Features section of your favorite Village Media website across Ontario.
Back to wrap on another episode of Inside the Village across the Village Media Network. Derek Turner, executive producer in the room. Michael Friscalanti, editor-in-chief. I'm Scott Sexsmith. He was great. That kick, though.
That was something, yeah.
75 years old?
Neither of us. Is he 75? Neither of us could do that. Well, not even close.
We could, but
I would not be
it
able to
would
do
not
that.
End well.
No, it would not end well.
The pain?
Yeah.
The next, well, not even the next day, the immediate pain, the aftermath pain.
Yeah, no, it's great. I'm glad he's in good shape. He went through a bit of a scare there. It's really good to see that he's come out the other side. And that was a fascinating conversation. And I told you it would be before we started.
Yep.
Just because it's a topic that everybody has an opinion on, the justice system, and the justice system sucks, and they need to overhaul it and fix it. But then you talk to a guy who spent his career in it and just defending really the beauty of our justice system. It is. Nothing's perfect, Scott, but as a guy who sat through a lot of big trials, and I understand the court system as well as most average Joes would. I'm not a lawyer or a judge, but I cover a lot of stuff in courts. It's really fascinating to talk to a guy like that.
Certainly is. We haven't read the book yet, full disclosure, but we're going to get it, and you can do so at bethejudge.ca, and we know that it's available at least at Kohl's.
Yes, yes. If you Google it too, you'll find it. You Be the Judge, Norman Douglas.
You Be the Judge at bethejudge.ca. Great chat. Okay, that's it for us this week. We'd love to hear your comments on the show with Storm and Norman. You can do so at itv@villagemedia.ca. And, of course, watch all episodes of the program at insidethevillage.ca, wherever you get your favorite podcast, and across the Village Media Network. For Derek Turner, executive producer, Michael Friscalanti, editor-in-chief here at Village Media, I'm Scott Sexsmith. Thanks for watching.
You've been listening to Inside the Village.
Frisco and Scott's wardrobe provided in part by Moores, Sault Ste. Marie.